Good morning. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily. Nice to be with you this Friday morning on RN. Daniel Browning here, filling in for Michael Cathcart, who's in Ubud in central Bali for the Writers Festival. Lucky Michael. Today on the show, I'm joined by the cinema and pop culture legend, the director John Landis, whose films include The Blues Brothers and An American Werewolf in London. And we hear about a very special ceremony that's being reenacted to open the Melbourne International Arts Festival. Stay with me here on Books and Arts Daily. But first today, to this year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. It's a big one, and it's gone to the Canadian author Alice Munro. The 82-year-old writer has been described by the Swedish Nobel Academy as a master of the contemporary short story. She's the first Canadian-based writer to secure the honour. And here's Peter Englund, the Academy's permanent secretary, making the announcement.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2013 is awarded the Canadian author Alice Munro, master of the contemporary short story. Thanks.
Well, joining me now to discuss Alice Munro and her win is Carolyn Kellogg, the book editor at the LA Times. Hi, Carolyn. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Now, Alice Munro is considered one of the greatest living writers who working in the form of the short story, beloved by readers around the world for her striking portraits of women who live in small-town Ontario. What do you know of Alice Munro?
She not only seems to be a universally adored artist, but she seems to be somebody who everybody just likes. There has not been nary an unkind word towards her win.
And the American author, novelist Jonathan Franzen says she's the remote provider of intensely pleasurable private experiences. Quite a rap. And also her compatriot, the short story writer Cynthia Ozick, has described her as Canada's version of Chekhov. There's a feeling in the literary community, what you're saying, is that she deserves this honour and that the Nobel Academy has got it right.
Well, I think frequently people like to say the Nobel Academy has gotten it wrong, so they must have gotten it right if nobody's complaining.
Can you, just for our listeners who may not have read the work of Alice Munro, encapsulate her style? I mean, how would you describe it to someone who'd never read the work of Alice Munro?
Well, the novelist Mona Simpson, who's based out of Los Angeles, told us today that she's innovative and quiet and understated. And my colleague David Yulin says that it exhibits a sneaky fierceness, because with intimacy, she's never sentimental. She does these very quiet portraits that are incisive and sometimes show the weaker side of our motivations or our actions.
Now, as I mentioned at the outset, Alice Munro is the first Canadian-based writer to win the honour and only the 13th woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. There's still an imbalance there in terms of gender, would you say?
Clearly, but I have to say things are looking up. In the last decade, there have been 4 women, so that's almost 40% in the last decade, or 11 years, and it was more like 1% overall. So that's an improvement.
Mm. Now, of course, she's not... there's quite a bit of money that goes along with the Nobel Prize. I think the equivalent is about $1.3 million. And there has been some talk that Alice Munro is on the verge of retirement. Do you know anything about what she plans to do in the future?
Well, you know what's really beautiful about this is that she told us in 2006 that she was retiring and she wasn't going to write anymore. And her concerns then were that she would write bad work and that people would see it. But she wasn't able to stop herself from going back to the laptop or typewriter or computer. This summer, she also said that she was going to stop writing. She was retired and she was done. But she seems like someone who takes such joy from the writing. I have a hard time imagining her actually stopping.
Now, the public never knows who's in the running for the Nobel Prize. I mean, obviously, it's judged by an academy, and those negotiations are in secret. But there's always a lot of speculation about who's going to win. Do we know who was tipped before news came through that Alice Munro had won?
Well, the Ladbrokes, the house in England that takes bets, they had Haruki Murakami as the top contender.
And
the Japanese novelist.
Yeah, and also I think a Belarusian author as well.
Yeah, she was making Svetlana. Svetlana was like the coming up from the outside in the very last couple days.
Svetlana Alexievich.
Thank you for saying it right. I was afraid I would get it wrong. I think the interesting thing about her is that she's not very well known here in America and maybe not in Australia, but Alice Munro definitely is. She's one that we're very familiar with.
Now, and this honors a lifetime of work, not just one book like The Man Booker. I mean, this honors a commitment to the craft of writing.
Generally, it does. Although the Academy, the Nobel Committee gives themselves room to make an award specifically around a work, and I think when Hemingway won, it was specifically for The Old Man and the Sea, or with the emphasis on that book.
Right. Well, great to talk to you, Carolyn Kellogg. Carolyn is the LA Times book editor. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks for having me.
And Alice Munro, the Canadian writer, will be presented with her award at a formal ceremony in Stockholm, in the Swedish capital, on December the 10th. And that's the anniversary of the prize founder, Alfred Nobel's death in 1896. This is Books and Arts Daily, and you're on RN. I couldn't help singing along. That's the Mr. Archie Roach, the wonderful Mr. Archie Roach, and A Child Was Born Here. Books and Arts Daily here on RN. Well, the Melbourne Arts Festival opens today with hundreds of events on show across the city for the next 2 weeks. And today there is a very special opening event. It's called Tandirum. And it's a welcome to country by Aboriginal elders from the five Kulin nations. And the Kulin are the traditional owners of the place we now call Melbourne. The event's being held in the heart of the city, Melbourne's Federation Square, which is on contested land between the five clans. Joining me now is Josephine Ridge, the director of the Arts Festival, and Rachel Mazza, the artistic director of Ilbidgeri, Melbourne's Indigenous Theatre Company. Welcome, both of you, to Books and Arts Daily.
Hey, hi. Rachel here. Hi, Daniel. Great to talk to you.
Good morning. It's Josephine.
Morning, Josephine. Can I begin with you? Because it's an interesting way to open the Arts Festival, bringing back this incredibly important and significant ritual. Where did the idea of reenacting the Tandirum come from?
Look, the first idea was really that it shouldn't be an unusual idea to open a festival in Melbourne, a festival of Melbourne, with a celebration of Indigenous culture. It should be normal, and we're really, really proud that we've been able to do that this year. It's about connecting to this place, literally connecting to this place, and telling the stories. So when I spoke to Rachel about probably over a year ago now, and said that we wanted to do this, it was Rachel's idea then, and I'll let her talk about it. to conceive really a very ambitious plan, which is to bring together all of the five clans for a joint welcome. So
Rachel, before we get to that, Tandirum is a shared word in all the languages of the Kulin. What does it mean?
It's essentially the parallel word for corroboree, but we didn't use that word. Oh, in Victorian, Aboriginal mob didn't use that word down here. They used Tandirum, and that's literally this ceremony, coming together for ceremony, sort out business, to party, to get together, to share food. Yeah.
And I understand, you know, it was it's a diplomatic kind of rite, and people exchange gifts in the way Tandiram was conducted by the Kulin in the past.
Yeah, there's parallels that I can draw on, you know, because I look at the society that we all grew up in, this Western society, and we don't have direct parallels. But what you could compare it to is we all understand that when you come to someone's house, you don't just walk in, you knock on the door. You wait for someone to come in and open the door and greet you, and only then do they invite you into their house. But once you've been invited in, you know that you're going to get a cup of tea and a biscuit. And you know you're going to be pretty safe once you're in there. So you're their guest, they're your host.
And you often bring something.
Yeah, and you often, exactly. Who doesn't come with a piece of cake that you picked up on the way or some bread or a toilet roll?
Rachel,
other parallel that actually, because it's visiting country, but it's actually also the other parallel I'll draw on is this is our version, Blackfella version of Parliament House. This is where serious business gets discussed and talked about, and often, you know, really serious business. So whether that's you know, disagreeing over, you know, boundaries. You know, this is where you would come together. This was the forum in which that serious stuff would get sorted out as well as cultural and as well as just pure fun.
And that river there, the Yarra River, Birrarung, it is the boundary. It is a boundary for two of the nations,
well,
two of
here,
the clans.
Here
the
you highlight straight away one of these contested boundaries that I'm alluding to. So already, and this is what I think so fantastic, so incredible about this Tandiram, which just picking up on your earlier word of reenactment, it's not so much a reenactment, it actually is a Tandiram in practice. So it is a living, breathing, you know, we're doing it now, this is it, as opposed to a reenactment.
Sure, thanks for going.
But certainly already one of the big pieces of business that the Kulin mob are in negotiation about, and it's not been resolved, and it was an ongoing negotiation that's happening between the Bunurong and the Wurundjeri over where what country that boundary meets and what area is shared interest. And there is, like all politics, there is a ongoing process there, and you know, the mobs in many instances aren't in agreement as to where that boundary is. So, but like our leaders and our elders, there is a respectful process in which they will conduct this negotiation. But it's an ongoing negotiation, and that's hopefully what our Tandiram this year is embracing. Here's an opportunity for these elders to come together and continue that kind of negotiation.
Let's talk about the ceremony itself. How have you imagined it? Because the Wurundjeri has played a key role in imagining how this is going to play out.
I've definitely seen myself, it's not my country, I'm not Kulin, my mob's Queensland and Torres Strait, I'm Yidinji and Comet. So I come as a visitor. To this country, and I defer the leadership of the vision of this Tandiram to those who rightfully it should sit, to the elders of the Kulin Nation. So I very much gathered with this mob several times in the build up towards this. Which, let me tell you, was an achievement in itself. Everyone's got busy lives and the politics involved. But certainly through these gatherings, we've been able to shape slowly. And, of course, I've got to put my little 2 cents worth in with my director's hat on. You know, got to make sure it's a great night out as well. So I've helped kind of facilitate and shape. So as, but it's in support of and being led by the elders of the five Kulin mob.
Josephine, to you, the celebrations after the Tandiram, it continues. There's a concert that beautiful man Archie Roach is going to be performing with some of his friends, and I understand this show creation is a repertoire that fuses old, new, and I think some unearthed demos they've found in the shelves somewhere.
Yes, that's right. And I think that predominantly the focus is on Archie's early works, it coincides with the release of a new CD, and it's basically his new show, and we're really, really fortunate to
And hence be the title Creation,
hence
of course.
The title Creation. And he's joined, as you've said, by an amazing lineup of singers and musicians, Lou Bennett, Emma Donovan, Delene Briscoe, a whole range of amazing artists, and a 10-piece band, including strings. So it's a big effort, and that will follow immediately after the Tanderem, and run for about an hour. And there is still time then for people to get into various theatres for the other shows which are following the opening.
And, of course, it's all free, so I'd be racing all you mob down there, out there.
Rachel.
Racing in to get yourself a stone.
And I just to clarify that timing, that the Tanderem starts at 6 in Federation Square.
Rachel, I saw something, I'm just going back to Tanderem, I saw something on Facebook that you'd posted, and it looked like you were hard at work there with a needle and thread on some possum skin cloaks. So they'll be worn there.
As part of, and just to kind of backtrack a sec, the conversation that Josephine and I have had, and, you know, much to your credit, Josephine, who's real and meaningful commitment to this, building this relationship with the Kulin Nation. So this is a 3-year commitment. So this year we're going to build on and then build on again for the 3rd year. So as part of this build-up is the cultural a series of cultural practices and workshops that will lead into the event. So very much this incredible opportunity to get the communities fully and richly engaged through dance workshops, relearning language in some cases, making possum skin cloaks and dance artifacts.
Dance machines.
Sound like a museum piece again. dance belts, you know, making the belts woven, armbands, headdresses, how to paint up. So, really, this is an opportunity to there's a lot of fantastic work going on in the communities already, but now it's kind of an opportunity to bring all that together with a kind of really big outcome, big focus for this ceremony that'll happen once a year. So, yeah, we've been running a series of workshops in these areas, and let me tell you that is such an honour and a privilege. As I say, I'm a visitor to this country, so to be able to share these cultural practices with the mob down here has been is such an honour.
Daniel, if I could just add, I was in yesterday. I was at the Northcote Town Hall where rehearsals have been taking place, and one of the really wonderful things about it was the young children from 4 and 5 years old through to people at the other end of their lives, and everybody in between. So, you know, an incredible cross-generational exchange.
And
of,
that's actually
of
quite
culture.
A rare thing, isn't it? A rare, I'm talking about in terms of this Western modern culture, where a community can all share in one event from right across the age spectrum. Mm. And I'll jump on that one too, Josephine, to watch those the dance workshops being run. And the little fellas are just as kind of seriously kind of being taken seriously, but seriously contributing and as much as the old fellas. And they're learning together. It's such a phenomenal experience to be a witness to, and obviously to be a part of.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Daniel Browning, and I'm with Josephine Ridge, the director of the Melbourne International
Arts
Festival.
Artistic
director of the Melbourne International Arts Festival, and Rachel Mazza, the artistic director of Ilbidgery, Melbourne's Indigenous Theatre Company. Josephine, how does this fit into your wider vision over those 3 years for the larger festival? I'm talking about how does Tanderem fit into that?
It It has a connection with the broader vision, which goes beyond our commitment to Indigenous culture, because it's also part of really wanting to open, broaden the invitation that the festival is making to audiences in Melbourne. So to start with a big, inclusive, free event, but also throughout the program, I think you'll see evidence of us really wanting to ensure that we engage as broadly as we can in dance, in music, in theatre as well. So it fits beautifully within that. But it's also, you know, as you've heard Rachel talk, you know, this Tanderrum is a very particularly Melbourne story. Mm. So that's really what Melbourne Festival does best and should continue to do, which is to really reflect and speak to and respond to the DNA of Melbourne, the personality of Melbourne. And that's really what we're trying to do throughout the program.
We've only got a minute left, so Josephine, can you kind of give us some of the other highlights for the Melbourne Arts Festival? We'll be talking about a couple of other things on the show today, but what are some of the other highlights we can see?
Okay, well, I can. We have on Saturday night we have another amazing Indigenous event where we have Gurumul, with special guest Sarah Blasco in Sydney Meyer Music Bowl, and the weather's looking good. We have a world premiere on Saturday night of a work by Hofe Schechter, an amazing contemporary dance choreographer, a work called Sun. He's chosen Melbourne to present this work for the first time. Tonight we have another dance work by an Irish company, Fabulous Beast. This has just had an enormous success at Brisbane Festival. We are presenting it. It's a double bill, both Stravinsky works, Rite of Spring and Petrushka, and Brief Encounter, a beautiful romantic piece of theatre, pure entertainment, absolutely beautiful.
We will have to put all those details on our website because we are right out of time.
Okay.
Thank you to the both of you, Josephine and Rachel.
Thanks, Daniel.
Josephine Ridge from the Melbourne International Arts Festival and Rachel Mazza, the Artistic Director of Ilbidgery, the Melbourne Indigenous Theatre Company. Well, one of the shows at the festival is Nicola Gunn's In Spite of Myself. It's a one-woman show, and it's hard to categorise because it's a mix of performance, lecture, workshop and self-help forum, exploring the absurdities of performance art. The show is about a performance artist also named Nicola Gunn, who's launching a retrospective exhibition of her life's work. It's the real Nicola Gunn's subversive commentary on the art world, and it's been described as a kind of mind-bending exploration of the nebulous line between who we are, who we say we are, and who we seem to be. Miyuki Yoki Ranta went along to meet Nicola Gunn and to explore the show In Spite of Myself.
I would like to open with a quote. Some people may think you are vile, but who cares? Just do good work. Jonathan Kaner. Good evening. My name is Susan Becker. I am the newly appointed International Director of Art Projects at the ACM and Executive Curator of this retrospective. Exercises in Hopelessness, Nicola Gunn, 1979 to present.
The foyer of the Fairfax Theatre has been transformed into a sort of a contemporary gallery space with a flooring and wall with some exhibition pieces. I guess you get a sense of the kind of work that this performance artist makes. I mean, they're her works, it's her retrospective. You're entering into an art world.
A retrospective that recognises and celebrates the universe.
And as the performance starts, there is a very stern but warm woman that welcomes us into the space.
No, I think that's a mistake.
And starts giving us a slight overview of what we're about to experience. Can you tell us who this character is? It will have to lead us through the performance.
Her name is Susan Becker. She is the curator of the exhibition. And she put all the works together, and I guess she's somewhat of a fan of Gunn's work and knows it quite intimately.
I am privileged. I am really thrilled to welcome you to this significant event that not only remembers Nicola Gunn's past work, but unveils two new specially commissioned works, Disappointment Mountain and Very Important Person. In addition, Nicola will deliver the keynote essay as part of this retrospective program via Skype, courtesy of the Australia Arts Council. The title of her essay, The Receiving House for Organic Waste, Upcycling as a Metaphor for the Commodification of Art and the Elderly.
And the piece is highly intellectual. I mean, it references Deleuze, Foucault, a series of artworks, a series of ficto-factual artworks. So why...
I think my intention is not to reflect the art world. It's reflecting the world as it is. Because what the art world does is reflect society.
Works like Very Important Person characterise Nicola's strong social practice. Within the work, she has engaged five older women on a rotating roster in a sweatshop model for art making. Using one colour and 500 kilograms of plasticine, the key work they'll be making during the performance is moulding a field of figurines that the artist proceeds to destroy. None of this is acknowledged. The old women, their steady production line, or the artist stepping on their efforts, leading the spectator to question who is the very important person.
Can I get your name, please?
Pauline.
Pauline. And Pauline, what is, as one of the sweatshop old ladies in the program, what's your role?
Basically, it's just to produce the little figures that are part of the Very Important Person art project, and we're keeping a fairly low profile.
How did you get involved in the project?
I really didn't have much choice. Nicola is my daughter. Yes, I wasn't given a choice.
Forced by association.
Forced by association, yeah.
I guess it's a work about identity, it's the work about politics of art making, it's about artistic process and sort of the slippages between reality and unreality and identities.
Because it is a one-woman show.
Yeah, there's really only one character really in the show. I mean, the conceit is that Susan Becker is another creation of Nicola Gunn.
So, who is the real Nicola Gunn? In the five site-specific videos, she can be heard singing I'm So Happy repeatedly while dancing and performing the following. Hitting herself with two pieces of limp celery in the forecourt. Hiding under a blue curtain with Jeffrey Rush. Jumping on the red leather couches in the level 5. Hitting herself with leaves in the garden along the length of the windows of the bistro, predominantly frequented by subscribers and other old people. Going up and down the single working elevator. So, who is the real Nicola Gunn? Who cares?
The thing I started with was a fear of irrelevance. And, you know, I think as artists, we're constantly wondering when we no longer become relevant, when what we have to say is no longer important, because there is this a trend towards embracing the new, the young, the... The forever new, you know, and I'm in my mid-30s now. I mean, I'm by no means old, but I'm not an emerging artist anymore. Mm-hmm. There's this trend of women in their 50s and beyond who are no longer seen, especially in the arts.
What do you think the figurines mean that you keep making?
What do they mean? Well, I hope it's not an exercise in hopelessness. I think it's more an exercise in hope. That's what we're doing. We're making hope. As she says, she makes openings, and that's what we do.
This is important. I want you to try to make something beautiful. I know it isn't easy in this context. Break apart the plasticine into two pieces. One piece should be slightly larger than the other piece. Now work them into balls. Put one ball on top of the other ball. Should be about 12 centimetres high. It doesn't matter if it's 1 centimetre either side. Imagine that you're making a snowman. Now smooth the join. I've been been making these works for years and they never get any better. But you're doing very well there, though. Take another 5 minutes.
Nicola Gunn in her one-woman show In Spite of Myself, which runs until this Sunday at Melbourne's International Arts Centre. Sorry, Melbourne Arts Centre, as part of the Melbourne International Arts Festival. Nicola is also holding a one-off participatory public forum, In Spite of Everything, to discuss the ideas relating to contemporary arts practice. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. Details on our website. This is Books and Arts Daily. You're on RN. I'm Daniel Browning.
This week on All in the Mind, the healing power of music.
Some of the standout moments have been working with people who might be coming out of a coma and not verbal at all, and then having that moment in therapy when you're singing and they'll suddenly come out with a word.
Then catch the Philosopher's Zone. This week, solitary confinement as a philosophical problem.
Philosophers haven't engaged with these issues, even as an ethical issue.
All in the Mind, followed by the Philosopher's Zone.
5 to 6 this Sunday on RN.
Well, my next guest is a man who's created some of the most entertaining films in cinema history. I'm going to reel off some of his films. I'm sure you will have seen some, if not most of them. Here we go. The Blues Brothers, An American Werewolf in London, Trading Places, Three Amigos, Coming to America, Animal House. And, of course, he directed what many consider to be the most influential pop music video of all time, Michael Jackson's Thriller. I'm speaking, of course, of John Landis. John's here as a guest of the Melbourne International Arts Festival, which is paying homage to him with an extensive retrospective of his work. Hi, John. Welcome to Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you.
A retrospective of your work. Does it make you feel like, you know, a seasoned director, which you are, but do you think to yourself, I've got so much more to do?
I'm still working, if that's what you mean. It's an interesting choice of films. I've made a lot more movies than that, but I said I would only come if they showed movies that had never been shown here. So they are showing two documentaries I made, Slasher and Mr. Warmth, both of which I'm very proud of, so I'm happy about that.
So that was the condition for coming out?
Well, that's my condition.
Well, I did reel off a list of those films that you've made, some of the films you've made, and many of them were box office gold in the 80s. But there's a common theme at play with those characters. We've got the frat house shenanigans of Animal House, the homeless man played by Eddie Murphy in Trading Places, and, of course, Jake and Elwood in the Blues Brothers. That sense of rebelliousness, does that come from the 60s? Where does that sense of rebelliousness come from?
I'm not sure I agree with you, but if it's there, it's certainly... I was born in 1950, so I'm definitely a child of the 60s. Mm. I mean, I was a teenager the whole 60s.
Do you agree they're kind of rebel...
Some of them, yeah, absolutely.
Characters?
You try to be as subversive as you can, but mostly you try to entertain. I mean, in terms of what you call rebelliousness and stuff, I mean, this goes back to Chaplin and Keaton and, you know, silent comedy. I remember with the Blues Brothers when people said at the time when it came out, they went, oh, my God, Crashing Cars, is that funny? And I wanted to say, have you ever seen the Keystone Cops? Max said it, thought so. One of the things about movies, they're completely subjective, like everything else. So, fine, I'll take it.
The Blues Brothers was made in 1979 with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd in the starring roles. Let's have a listen.
Well, me and the Lord, we got an understanding.
We're on a mission from God.
We're putting the band back together.
Forget it. No way.
We're on a mission from God. Matt, me and Elwood, putting the band back together.
Ma'am, you gotta understand that this is a lot bigger than any domestic problems you might be experiencing.
Would it make you feel any better if you knew that what we're asking Matt here to do is a holy thing?
You see, we're on a mission from God.
John Landis, you compiled an incredible stellar cast of legendary performers to make cameo roles in that film, The Blues Brothers. Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, James Brown, John Lee Hooker. How did you manage that?
Cab Calloway? Sadly, it was easy because one of the things about the Blues Brothers that makes it special to me is Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi had a real passion for Black American music, rhythm and blues. And at that time, in 1979, it was all disco. I mean, the acts were ABBA and the Bee Gees, very white. And the sad thing is this, you know, even Motown wasn't selling then. And you just called them and said you want a job. They were very happy for it. It's very unique, that picture, because John and Danny, who were huge stars at that moment, literally exploited their own celebrity to focus a spotlight on these truly great American artists. And I'm happy to say that if you read B.B. King or Aretha Franklin or James Brown, all of them in their autobiographies talk about how that picture was totally successful on that. It brought it back in a way that it's hard to believe now. I mean, you know, Universal Studios, who made the movie, refused the album. They said, who would buy this music? It was quite something, and now it's hard to accept. But
unimaginable. I understand the film wasn't shown in predominantly white neighborhoods. It's hard to even imagine.
It was considered, the exhibitors at the time had a lot of power, and there were exhibitor screenings around the country, and they perceived it as a black movie. They said, "Well, what white kids will go see this movie?" It was truly an ignorant response. I mean, I don't want to say racist, because it was more stupid than racist, because they saw, well, you know, who listens to Aretha Franklin? It was like, excuse me? You know, what? Just shows how out of touch they were. And we actually opened, instead of the, at that time, movies opened in between 900 and 1,200 theaters nationally. We opened in 600 theaters. I'm happy to say we were still a huge hit. But that just shows that conventional wisdom is often wrong.
You've been quoted as saying that the Blues Brothers would never be made today. Why?
Well, it could be made, just not by a studio. Right. Because it's too radical, it's too out there and insane. You know, I was coming off of Animal House. John and Danny were coming out of the biggest TV show, Saturday Night Live, and we had already recorded the first album, Briefcase Full of Blues, which was a triple platinum album. So we went into this with a lot of arrogance and power. I mean, for me, the Blues Brothers is so silly. I mean, it's profoundly silly. And the most important part of an actor on film, his eyes. So we put them in dark glasses. You know, we were so perverted. We were like going out of our way to be insane. And for me, the sense of the whole movie is captured in the sequence at the end, when the entire forces of the state are converging on the Cook County building, Daley Plaza, where you've got the military, the police, the state police, the city police, the sheriffs, the fire department. You've got everybody convert, thousands of tanks and troops and men converging, and you cut to Jake and Elwood in the elevator listening to that music. Very still. That, to me, that's the whole movie. It's just silly.
What can you say about the state of Hollywood comedy? If a major studio wouldn't make a film like the Blues Brothers,
well, there were a couple of films last year I thought were really good. I liked Bridesmaids very much, and I also thought Ted was very funny. So those are bright spots. There will always be good movies made, just not as many. I mean, they used to. Major Hollywood releases between, you know, 1969 to 1985, you'll be astonished how many wonderful movies every year. And, you know, I used an example last year, you know, Argo, where people were so thrilled with Argo, which one was a terrific movie. But I think part of the thrill was they were going, gee, this isn't stupid, because it's just economics. I mean, all the studios have no personalities anymore. They just are international financiers and distributors, and things change. But they'll always be good movies.
Do you think there's, you know, people are too focused on taste and, you know, capturing the kind of popular, the zeitgeist?
The zeitgeist and taste, that's an oxymoron. I mean, I wouldn't...
Well, the popular taste, you know.
Well, I think the popular taste is often misunderstood. You know, the dumbing down or the lowest common denominator, you know, the market has changed the international market, you know, it used to be that American films, for instance, made 70% of their money in America and 30% overseas. Ironically, the Blues Brothers, the first American film to gross more foreign than domestic, made about $200 million foreign and $80 domestic. Mm. It was very successful. But now it's reversed. I mean, now Russia and China, these giant markets. And so when they make movies now, they think, will this play? Because it's got to play in Rio de Janeiro and Kigali and Shanghai and Pittsburgh and Melbourne. You know, they really do think that way. And yeah. So that's why you see so many superheroes and comic book movies, because they're easily understood. Marketing has become so expansive that the economics are kind of wacky. But still, in many ways, technology, the irony is that technology has made it easier and cheaper to make movies than ever, but it's harder to get those movies into theaters.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. You're with me, Daniel Browning, and I'm with the director, film legend, John Landis, the subject of a retrospective at the Melbourne International Arts Festival. I can call you a legend because you're the subject of a retrospective at the Melbourne International Arts Festival, John Landis.
It sounds like I never existed.
Let's talk briefly now about how you got your start, because it does sound like a very Hollywood story. You were 16 when you joined the mailroom at Fox Studios, and you actually worked on a spaghetti western. Is that true?
Many, but not when I was 16.
Well, after that.
You don't join a studio. It's not the military.
No.
You know, I got a job as soon as I was legally
able. In the mailroom?
Yeah, as soon as I was legally able to leave school, I did, because I was very passionate. I wanted to be a filmmaker when I grew up. And, you know, being a filmmaker, it's not like if you want to be a dentist or a mechanic.
It's pretty clear what you have to do.
Yeah, they're rule. You know, you're an architect. You go, you do this, you do this, you do this, and you get a piece of paper. It's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, he has a medal. He has a document. But if you want to be a filmmaker, all you really need is someone to give you the money to make a movie. So I wanted to be near production as much as possible. And I was very lucky. I grew up in L.A., when they still had the back lots, you know. And so I was able to get a job as a mailboy at Fox. I was there about a year. And then I got a job on a movie called Catch 22 on the second unit, which I hated. And I was not there very long because it was flying in these B-25s. It was horrible. And I went back to the mailroom. It was very exciting. In 1967, 68, when I was in the mailroom at Fox, they were making Beneath the Planet of the Apes. They were shooting on the lot, MASH. Patton was shooting in Spain. They had all of this TV production, all the Irwin Allen shows, Lost in Space, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. They had the Green Hornet. So I knew Bruce Lee pretty well, because nobody cared about him. He was just Kato, but he was a fascinating guy. And then I'm trying to think. There was so much. Tora, Tora, Tora. I watched him do the miniatures, which were fantastic, where now is a big shopping center in Century City. But so I was – it really was – you know when you see movies and they show Hollywood studios in the old days and they're showgirls and cowboys and lobster men? It was exactly like that. In fact, one of the great moments of my life, I think, was they were shooting Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and also on stage was George Cukor's film Justine, which has a transvestite ball in it. And there were like 300 big guys in drag having lunch with about 200 gorillas. And it was like one of the – I thought, I love this. What other business can I be in? This is incredible. So I loved being in the mailroom, and I finally was able to – a man named Andrew Martin, who was directing second unit on a picture that was released as Kelly's Heroes, said, if you can get to Yugoslavia – he wanted me to get to Belgrade. I could probably get you on the second unit. So I lied to my mom and told her I had a job and bought a ticket, which I could buy a ticket to get me to London. I was pretty stupid. I didn't know. I thought, London, Europe, Yugoslavia, well, you know, how far could it be? And I went to London, and then this was 1969, so it's very different. I had long hair, meant I could hitchhike anywhere safely. It's a very different time. I rode the rail. I went under the Iron Curtain under a freight car with some Swedish hippies. And I was very lucky that MGM wasn't lucky, but I was lucky because the production was very screwed up. And I got there about a month before filming, and I ended up working on the first unit. I was there 9 months. It was, I think, the best time of my life. I turned 19 there.
We talked about, I guess, the racial barriers around the way the Blues Brothers was distributed and seen. Coming to, you know, something that really influenced me, Michael Jackson's Thriller video, there were issues with whether MTV would screen that. That
well, that video. Was already – that had happened before Thriller. That was – Walter Yetnikoff, who was the head of CBS Records. MTV lived and died on free videos. They were, you know, they didn't want to pay for anything, so they got free videos, which were essentially commercials to sell records. And they did have a corporate policy, no black acts. And Walter Yetnikoff said, if you want any CBS artist, and at that time, that was huge, then you have to play, I think it was Beat It or Billie Jean. I forgot which was first. I think maybe Billie Jean. You must play it. And they went, oh, okay. And then Michael was such an extraordinary success that, so really it was Walter Yetnikoff and Michael Jackson. That's true.
What do you remember about making that video? What did you think when you were approached? I assume it was your first music video.
Michael Jackson called me.
It was a mini film.
He called me. I was in London, and he called me up, and essentially he was very taken with An American Werewolf in London, and in particular the work of Rick Baker, who won an Oscar, the first makeup Oscar. I think he has 8 now. He's an overachiever. But Rick is brilliant. And Michael wanted to turn into a monster. And what I didn't know was I didn't really want to make a rock video because they were commercials. And I thought, well, Michael is such a monster star that perhaps I could bring back the theatrical short. That's why it's 15 minutes, because it's the length of a two-reeler, like a Bugs Bunny cartoon or Three Stooges short. I could bring back the theater. So I made a deal to do that. And then CBS Records, in fact, Mr. Yetnikoff refused to pay for it because it was very expensive. At that time, they would spend $30,000 to $50,000 to do these things. Well, I can't shoot non-union. They were all non-union. I couldn't shoot non-union in L.A. I wouldn't want to. Plus, it was very elaborate. Had a huge makeup call. I insisted. I think one of the reasons it worked so well is I insisted the dancers have 10 days rehearsal. So they were crack. And it ended up costing about $500,000. I've heard many numbers, but the true number is $500,000, which was huge then. But it was a theatrical short. So Michael said, well, I'll pay for it. I said, absolutely not. And George Folsey, my partner and editor at the time, he's the one who suggested we film us filming it, which became the making of Thriller. And that's how we financed Thriller, because we sold that hour, Thriller and the making of Thriller. We went to MTV and they said, we don't pay for anything. So we said, fine. So we went. There was a new cable channel called Showtime. And they said, okay, we'll give you $250,000. So for $250,000, they had to write to show it for 10 days before anyone else. But Showtime was very small then. I mean, it was several hundred thousand people. MTV went insane and said, how can you? We said, okay, you give us money, you're next. And they gave us $250,000. And that's how we financed it. And everything about Thriller was a surprise. I didn't, it was no one's, you know, I've heard they, at Harvard Business School, they actually taught a course about Thriller. But the truth is, it was because Michael wanted to turn into a monster. Thriller did so many remarkable things. The album, when we made Thriller, the album had been out for over a year. It was already the most successful album of all time. It had been number one a year and now was somewhere in the mid, I don't know, 5 or 6. They had done Billie Jean and Beat It. Both had been huge. And when I proposed this, I'll never forget, Michael calls Walter Yetnikoff. He goes, Walter, here, talk to John Landis. And I pick up the phone and profanity screaming out of the, you think you're going to buy it? Okay, thanks. Give it back to Michael. And Michael said, well, I'll pay for it. And I said, no, you won't. So George had that idea. We made it. It was supposed to, it played theatrically in Los Angeles with Fantasia. It was so huge, it made so much money in like 2 weeks that they kind of screwed me because they pulled the trigger, CBS did, which was the right thing for them to do, because the album then tripled its sales. You have to realize it was the most successful record of all time and then tripled its sales. A man named Austin First called us and said, I'd like to put it out as a home video. And I said, who's going to pay $100 for this when it's on TV constantly? Well, what happened was there was something, you know, home video, when it started, the beta or VHS cassettes cost $80 to $100, which is why the rental business started, because no one could afford it. And this guy, Austin First, said, I'm going to sell through, which meant he charged $29.95. They sold 9 million of them. So it really started that. And then it did so many things, created the whole making of business and all this stuff. And it's amazing. I mean, it really was. It's the power of Michael, really. I mean, you know, he was such an extraordinary performer.
We're almost out of time, but I want to ask you about, there's two of your documentaries screening during this retrospective, a tribute to Don Rickles, the comedian, Mr. Warmth, and another film called The Slasher. This is the first time they've been screened in Australia, as you mentioned in earlier in the interview. But tell me about that form, the documentary film.
Well, documentaries are fantastic. I mean, there are many. First of all, there are no rules in documentary. Most documentaries, by the way, are not objective. I mean, something people do not understand, like when they say there should be a camera in Parliament or a camera, you know, where a camera is, what the lens is, how high it is, what angle it is, changes your point of view and changes your perception of what you're seeing. So the way a documentary is made, whether intended or not, is not reality. The reality television is a lie. You know, they write that stuff and they create situations. But documentary can really teach you a lot and show you things. And for instance, Mr. Warmth was made by me because I wanted people to respect Don and what he did and how unique it was. And that was completely successful. That was bought by HBO. I had to finance that myself. No one would give me money. But it is one of the funniest movies ever made. I'm not kidding. It is fall down funny. But it also is an examination of the man. Slasher is very different. Slasher was intended as one thing, but reality hijacked it and it became something totally different. I made it because I was so appalled by the way we were being lied to about weapons of mass destruction. The whole idea of invading Iraq was so egregious to me. I was so horrified. You know, the Saudis financed 9/11. Why are we going after? What? You know, I mean, it was such a lie. And everyone was buying into it. I kept thinking, I live in Beverly Hills. Why is my intelligence better? You know, I could not figure this out. So I intended that film to be about the invasion of Iraq. However, the gentleman, Michael Bennett, the slasher, it's a unique type of mercenary car salesman. They're like hired guns. They're hired to clear the lots. And everything about what happened was so surprising, and it just made a left turn, and the movie is totally different than what I intended, but fascinating. And I learned more about capitalism and value. And it also, by the way, it's tragic, but it's truly funny. But Mr. Warmth, I really, both of them, I'm very proud of. We're very successful in the States, and I would like people to see them. So,
well, they've got an opportunity at the Melbourne International Arts Festival with a tribute to John Landis, both those films, Mr. Warmth and Slasher, screening during the tribute. John Landis, thanks for being my guest here on Books and Arts Daily.
Thank you.
That's it for Books and Arts Daily for this week. Thanks to the team, executive producer Linda Lopresti, to producers Rhiannon Brown, Suzanne Donisthorpe, Kate Evans and Miyuki Yokiranta, to technical producer John Jacobs. Well, over the weekend here on RN, there's lots of arts coverage. Tune in to Weekend Arts tomorrow at 2 p.m. with Sarah Kanoski. And you can join our own Kate Evans with Books Plus on Sunday. That's at 2 p.m. But next here on RN, it's Bush Telegraph with Cameron Wilson. I'm Daniel Browning. It's been great to have your company. Michael Cathcart is back in the chair on Monday, and he's bringing you stories from the Ubud Writers Festival. Beautiful. Stay with the network throughout your day. Bye for now. Have a great weekend. We are coming up to news time here on RN.
If there's a song for every moment of our life, what would My Life as a Playlist sound like? Curate the soundtrack to your life and be involved with this fascinating study about music and emotions. Birthdays, childhood, love and heartbreak, weddings and funerals. How do you mark your milestones with music? Get involved. Find the link for My Life as a Playlist at the RN homepage.